This episode of Metatrex is brought to you by Enterprise in Space. Find out how you can help science and education and become a virtual crew member aboard the NSS Enterprise Orbiter. Visit enterpriseinspace.org for more information. And if you'd like to help us keep Star Trek discussion coming to you each day, consider becoming a patron of the network through Patreon. Visit patreon.com/trekfm and find out how you can become part of the team. That's patreon.com/trekfm.
This is Tim Russ, Lieutenant Commander Tuvok on Star Trek Voyager, and you're listening to Trek FM.
There's no greater challenge than the study of philosophy.
My philosophy is that there is room for all philosophies on this station.
Welcome to Metatrex, Trek FM show on Star Trek and philosophy. My name is Mike Morrison, and with me is Zachary Frühling. In this episode, part one of a two-part discussion on the problem of identity in Star Trek, we consider the metaphysical problem of self-identity of non-living objects over time, and then next week, we're going to discuss the problem of personal identity. Zachary, this was kind of the topic I chose because I have a fascination with metaphysics. What are your thoughts?
You know, I think when people think of Star Trek and philosophy, this is one of the issues that they think about. The problem of personal identity comes up in many places. And of course, you have some very classic examples from the history of philosophy dealing with the identity of inanimate objects over time, such as the Ship of Theseus example we're going to talk about in a few minutes. So when people think of Star Trek and philosophy, this is one of the classic topics. I'm excited to dive in.
Yeah, I am as well. Again, this is just something that I have a fascination with, metaphysics, ontology in particular. Metaphysics, of course, referring to the fundamental nature of being and the world around it. Here we're going to try to answer two basic questions, I think. Ultimately, you know, what is there and what is it like? I think those are the two questions probably that we try to answer when we talk about identity. When we talk about ontology, we're talking about, you know, what entities exist. You know, this is the debate of being. The word ontology, I think it comes from a blend of Greek words that literally mean the study of that which is. So we're trying to answer the question of what is existence? What does it mean to exist? So we're dealing with the properties of an object and how those properties relate to the object itself. So as someone who has an interest in philosophy and more specifically philosophy in the Star Trek universe, that's really a rich topic, I think, of exploration. And, you know, as we already said, we're going to discuss this week and also next week in Metatrex episode 5. But in truth, you know, I don't think we'll even be able to scratch the proverbial surface of this topic from either a philosophical point of view or even how it's dealt with in Star Trek. So I kind of predict here, I'm going to put on my my cap of prediction, and I think you and I are going to be revisiting this topic again down the road.
Well, I love discussing metaphysical topics, and that's because they're so abstract. They're the kinds of questions that aren't necessarily practical questions, right? Questions of ethics and politics and sociology and political philosophy have really practical import. And, you know, one thing that you get in philosophy that you don't get in other areas of thought are these radically abstract questions, questions of metaphysics. And we should spend a minute just to talk about the meaning of metaphysics before we dive in. Meta, of course, means beyond. And beyond. And physics, of course, is refers to, you know, the things in the physical reality. So metaphysics deals with the question of what else you have to postulate as part of your reality to explain the things we observe in reality. So as it applies to personal identity or the problem of identity or other metaphysical questions, you know, what other types of entities do you have to postulate, or what other accounts of time do you have to give in order to make sense of the things we observe about time or the objects that we can observe in physical reality? So metaphysics means literally beyond physics. And as such, philosophy inherently deals with the types of entities and questions that are by definition beyond the scope of the things that can be answered by the sciences.
Yeah. And I think when we talk about, you know, the metaphysical problem of identity over time, just kind of breaking it down into its simplest terms, we're talking about an object with respect to its parts. You know, we're asking the question here, is a thing the sum of its parts? And if those parts change over time, how is that thing different? And in the end, is it really the same thing? That's kind of how I look at that in its simplest terms.
Yeah, everything that exists in reality seems to undergo changes, right? My car out in my driveway, in fact, I can see it from my podcast studio here. My car undergoes changes, right? It has its oil change. It has parts swapped in and out. And as any object you want, whether it's a human being in your body or whether it's the automobile or could be the Starship Enterprise, right? Anything in the physical world undergoes changes in time as its parts come and go and undergo changes. So given that, what is the reason for thinking that an object stays the same over time, given that in some cases objects can undergo very radical change, right? I think if you look at the human body as an example, yeah, I think there's a statistic every 7 years, you know, every single cell in your body gets replaced. So in right. what sense are you the same body given that level of radical change, even when all the parts are swapped in and out?
Yeah, because you have the idea of mirological essentialism, I think, that says that an object cannot persist through the changes of its parts. So that kind of raises that counterpoint of that idea of something remaining the same.
There's an intuition that comes from the German philosopher Gottfried Wilhelm Leibniz. And he actually formulated, he was a mathematician, so he formulated it as a law, sort of a mathematical law. And it came to be called Leibniz's law. And the idea is this, that if two things are identical, in other words, if they really just are the same thing, then those two objects have all of their properties in common. So if you break this down and ask, what does it mean for two things to be what we call numerically identical, right? Two things are literally the same object. Like in mathematics, you get the sentence A equals A, right? If A equals A, those two variables refer to the exact same object. So that's what it means to refer to numerical identity. Two things that are really just the very same thing. Leibniz's law is basically this. If there are two things and they have all of their properties in common, then they really just are the same thing. And anything that's mathematically identical or numerically identical has to have all their properties in common. Otherwise, they would be two different things with two different sets of properties, right? And you can find a really simple example of this, right? Right now I've got in fact, it's people listening to this aren't going to see this, but I have a glass that I'm drinking some water out of, and it has a picture of the Starship Enterprise on it, right? If what does it mean for that glass to be identical to itself? Well, it has a bunch of properties. It has a certain height. It has a certain circumference. It has a certain amount of liquid in it. It's a certain color, and you can list all the properties of this glass on my table. And anything that has a different set of properties, a different color or a different height, whatever, is a different object. And if two things have literally all the same properties, you know, it is on the same location in my table. If it has the same height, has the same amount of water in it, on and on and on and on, listing all the properties, then that is literally the same glass, right? There's only one glass there, in other words. So that's what it means to be sort of numerically identical. So the interesting question, as it applies to identity over time, you know, over time, objects undergo changes, which means their properties change over time, right? My car has different properties when its tires go flat or when its oil gets changed. And if you ask, okay, given that the properties change over time, what reason do we have for thinking that that object is actually the same object? We normally call ourselves the same person over time. I don't think I have a different car today than I did yesterday. That's not the way we think or talk. That goes counter to our intuition. But given that change does occur over time, we need some justification for thinking that objects remain the same, that they persist even despite the changes they undergo.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Of course, when we're talking about Leibniz's law, I heard it said once that, you know, for instance, if Lois Lane says to herself, I don't think that Clark Kent can fly. And then she says to herself, I think Superman can fly. Therefore, Clark Kent and Superman are not identical. So, you know, you have to take into account, you know, our ability to observe. And I think that's an important point when we're talking about the identity of indiscernibles.
Yeah, and I think this is, again, this is, I don't want to get too heavy into the mathematics of Leibniz's law, but yeah. I do think there's a fundamental intuition there that if two things are literally different objects, different parts of reality, then they have different properties. And if they didn't have different properties, if they had the exact same properties, they would just be the same object. And that's a really strongly held intuition. I think that makes sense, right? Two different objects on my desk here in front of me have different properties, and that's how I can distinguish them from each other. So if they don't have different properties, they're the same object. Now we have to ask the question, okay, given that sort of fundamental problem, how do you start diving into this this philosophical topic through the lens of Star Trek?
Yeah, and I think we can jump right into what'll be the kind of the core of this discussion, and that is the ship of Theseus as an example. Theseus was in Greek mythology a king, and he had a ship, and that's where we get the name Ship of Theseus. And it undergoes a change in which the old boards were removed and stored away as they became creaky and weak, and they were replaced with new ones. And then the mast became weak and started tottering, and you know, the masts were replaced. So after 50 years, this ship has new boards, new masts, new everything. Is it still the Ship of Theseus? That's a great example.
Yeah, it really comes from a sort of a funny story from Plutarch and his biographies he gives a biography of Theseus in which he recounts the story, right? Theseus and the youth of Athens are on the way back from Crete, and their ship is falling apart around them, so they start replacing the planks and the masts and the oars as the parts wear out, and they store all the old parts, right? But you can ask the question, okay, given that they're starting to replace all the parts, right, the ship has different parts later in time than it used to have, in what sense is it really the same ship anymore? Is it still the Ship of Theseus, even as some of the parts, or in radical cases, if all the parts were replaced, would it be the same ship?
Yeah, and I immediately think of the Enterprise episode Dead Stop. You know, the NX-01 is significantly damaged. It requires major structural repair. It requires mechanical repairs to its system. So they end up in a space station that we later discover is powered by the neural energy of abductees from dozens of species. So the ship that rips out of that station, is it the same ship that went in after all of these repairs have been made? And we're kind of back to the Ship of Theseus. Is that ship sitting in the harbor still the same ship? Here in this episode from Enterprise, is the NX-01 still the NX-01 when it rips away from that space station? We can explore that question really again in Enterprise with E-squared. You know, even after the Zindi arc, we can, again, after all the incredible damage that Enterprise kind of had in season 4, we've got it seems like a totally new ship. It's all fixed. It's patched up. It looks fantastic. Is that the same ship, you know, where Enterprise was just so beat up, and yet season 4, we've got this, you know, new looking ship. I can totally see Trip, you know, walking onto the bridge and saying, "Captain, we replaced 30% of the hull. The bulkheads on C deck are all new, and I had to fabricate a new warp injector." So then, you know, Archer's kind of sitting there doing the math. You know, it's like he's like, "Okay, carry the 1, bring down the 7. Yep, add 0.1 to the registry. So NX-01.1 on the hull, and then get the dedication plate changed out right now, because we're not the same ship anymore."
As I was preparing for the show tonight, I was thinking, you know, how do you tell the Ship of Theseus story with Star Trek? And of course, the obvious way is to say, oh, well, it's not even a leap, right? You start talking about the Enterprise as the starship of Theseus. So yeah, that's what we want to do now. Let's talk about the changes that the Enterprise undergoes over time. Any version of a starship, right? But whether it's Archer's Enterprise or the original Enterprise in the original series, right? Over time, any starship is going to undergo changes, right? In the case of the original Enterprise, the Enterprise goes through a refit, right? You see the refit Enterprise in Star Trek the Motion Picture. It looks quite a bit different, has a lot of new components. Most of the ship has been replaced, right, compared to the version of the Enterprise you see in the original series. And, you know, take any of the ships or space stations that you see in Star Trek, and over time, those things undergo change. So, yeah, we're talking about the starship of Theseus tonight, not the Ship of Theseus, because that's ancient history, and here we're here to talk about the future. So what does the starship of Theseus mean for identity over time?
Yeah, it's still a sexy ship. That's just, you know, my opinion. And I think we need to be clear here. We're not talking about the evolution of, say, the NX-01 Enterprise to, say, the NCC-1701E. You know, for the sake of simplicity, I think we can all agree that those ships are very different. But, you know, what about the 1701 from the original series to the refit of the motion picture? You know, we pretty much understand it was a, you know, it was a refit. You know, it's significantly changed from the ship that we got to know in those first three seasons of the original series. And Decker, I mean, for crying out loud, Decker spends half the flipping movie talking to Kirk about how everything's different. You don't know this ship,
it's a whole
Kirk.
New Enterprise, it's different. Right?
It's a whole new Enterprise. The systems don't work like they used to. You're an idiot. You know, I love that air of, you know, you're an idiot, Kirk. And it's an interesting discussion. So, you know, NCC-1701, the ship of Theseus.
Yeah, I think every fan who's watched the original series and then watched, you know, Star Trek the Motion Picture has, even if they haven't explicitly asked the question of themselves, they've kind of had this intuition, right? Wait a minute, that's not the same ship. Almost everything is new. It has a new bridge module, a new warp core. It's had a radical structural refit. About the only thing that's in common on that ship is maybe the innermost structural space frame of the ship, right? Everything else about the ship has been replaced at that point. So in what sense is it the same Enterprise?
Yeah, the deflector's gone. It's got that nice, you know, modern-looking lit-up deflector. It's seemingly the same ship, but yet very much different. I think we can also look at this in terms of Deep Space Nine. You know, the station itself. You know, is it the same station after the Starfleet systems are integrated and the weapon systems are refit? You know, we can look at that and we can say, okay, is this the same station? You know, when we look at you know, rebuilding it from, you know, replaced components or fixing broken components in the episode Empok Nor, O'Brien takes that team on a salvage mission to, you know, to a virtually identical station to gather parts for Deep Space Nine. So, you know, again, we have to ask the question, does this change the identity of the station itself?
Well, the examples we used have a couple of different, we've used a couple of different kinds of examples, right? In the case of, say, Deep Space Nine, you know, if O'Brien swaps out a part, maybe there's a defective computer console and he takes out that computer console and replaces it with a new computer console. In the grand scheme of things, compared to Deep Space Nine as a whole, that's a really minor change, right? Only one little component has been replaced. I mean, it could be as simple as one bolt, you know, being replaced somewhere on the station, right? Compared to a very large scale change like the refit of the Enterprise from the 1701 and the 1701 post refit, right? That's a much greater percentage of the components of the Enterprise were replaced for that refit, right? So this is a question of scale, right? There are little changes, there are big changes, and any object you want can go through, you know, very minor changes or very big scale changes. But what's fun is to apply Leibniz's law that we mentioned at the beginning of the show to these examples, right? Regardless of the scale of the change, you know, even if it's just a matter of a single bolt being replaced, you know, let's say on Deep Space Nine, you know, one bolt somewhere on a ship, you know, on a maintenance hatch somewhere is
a self-sealing
stem bolt is replaced somewhere on Deep Space Nine.
We want to be specific about that.
Yeah, exactly. Let's say a single self-sealing stem bolt is replaced somewhere on Deep Space Nine, and that's the only change we're talking about. If we're talking about Deep Space Nine as a whole from the perspective of strict numerical identity, in other words, every single property that the station has being identical, right? Once any single property, no matter how minute, you know, a stem bolt being replaced, once the station undergoes any change at all, no matter how minute, the station is no longer identical with itself, right? On the one hand, you have the station with all of its properties and it has, you know, a certain stem bolt. And then, you know, a few minutes later, after O'Brien makes the change, the station has a whole list of properties with a different stem bolt. And it's a different list of properties. And that means under strict numerical identity that there's a danger that the station is no longer identical with itself. That, in other words, that the station is literally not the same station as it was a few minutes before. And I think that runs really counter to our intuitions. We tend to think of objects as persisting through time. And persisting regardless of these very minor changes, I think it's easier to make the case that the Enterprise refit is a totally different Enterprise than the Enterprise pre-refit. If we're talking about changing a single stem bolt, I think calling calling Deep Space Nine a completely different station than it was a few minutes ago runs counter to our intuitions. But again, if you go right back to Leibniz's law and you say, well, look, it doesn't matter how big the change is, even a very minor change means that the station's properties as a whole aren't the same anymore, and it's not the same station. The station is not numerically identical with its prior version of itself. So we're talking about a different Deep Space Nine than we had a few minutes ago. And that's counterintuitive, but I think, you know, there's a danger of kind of turning the problem of identity into a line drawing problem, right? There's these clear-cut cases where, you know, the Enterprise refit, okay, let's even assume that that's just a different Enterprise because it has most of its components replaced. But then at the other end of the spectrum, we've got these very minor changes like the stem bolt. It's, you know, the case I want to make here, I think, is that it's not just a question of where you draw the line. You know, how many changes do you have to make until you get a new version of the object, the ship or the station? Right. If you go back to Leibniz's law, this metaphysical idea that any two things that are identical have to have the same properties, it doesn't matter how big of a scale of change we're talking about. In other words, it's not a line drawing problem. Any change at all creates the danger that an object is not the same as itself, no matter how minor the change. So again, I want to keep going back to Leibniz's law, because otherwise we run the risk of just turning this into a practical line drawing problem. And I think this is a deeper metaphysical problem than that.
Yeah, and a really interesting one. And kind of the flip side of that, Zachary, is say we take the parts and pieces, and let's go back to the ship of Theseus. In that original story, as I remember it, and I'm drawing from, you know, way back, as I remember that story, as they took those planks off of the ship, they stored them away. As they replaced those masts, they stored the old masts away. So now we can kind of theorize and ask the question here, what if they took those parts and pieces and built a new ship? Is that the ship of Theseus?
Yeah, the philosopher Thomas Hobbes that we mentioned in episode 3 of MetaTreks last week, the philosopher Thomas Hobbes had this, he in thinking through this very problem, right? This is a well-known problem in the history of philosophy. Like we said, it goes all the way back to ancient Greek philosophy. But the British philosopher Thomas Hobbes asked the question, well, what if you took all those original parts that were discarded from the ship of Theseus and you put them back together? You know, would you then have two ships of Theseus, right? There's the ship that has steadily had all of its parts replaced over time to the point where every single part has been replaced and all the original parts were stored away and, you know, maybe they were even spread out a little bit and they had to be recollected. What if you collected all the original parts and put them back together? Would you then have two ships of Theseus, right? And again, this is a little counterintuitive. You might think on the one hand, well, no, that's stupid, right? You only have one ship of Theseus. You take all the parts apart, you put them back together somewhere, and that's the ship of Theseus. All the parts are the same, and those original parts are now somewhere else. But if you run the reasoning process through with this idea that an object can persist over time despite the changes it undergoes, as the original ship of Theseus has its parts being replaced, if one little component like a deck plank or a mast, a single oar on the ship, if any one of those changes does not result in the ship of Theseus being a different ship, then it doesn't matter how many of those iterations you undergo, right? Every single part that gets replaced means that the ship is still the same, the ship is still the same, the ship is still the same, regardless of how many parts we're talking about. And then, of course, if you take those original parts, you put them back together, it sure looks like in that case you've got two ships of Theseus then. And again, this is, if you're not sort of getting involved in the mental thought experiment here, you might go, well, wait a minute, that's stupid, right? The original, it's only like a great many philosophical thought experiments. There's always the danger of going, wait a minute, that's absurd, right? This is a paradox for a reason. It seems like it's a counterintuitive conclusion, and that means there's a philosophical problem to be solved. So the counterintuitiveness of this example is not a reason to reject the philosophical problem. That means there's a philosophical problem to be solved. It means our intuitions aren't matching up in some way, and hopefully, in thinking through the philosophical examples, maybe we can make some sense of this, right? So as I think about what this means for Star Trek, you know, let's go back to the example of the original Enterprise refit. Right. Suppose in doing the refit, they took off a great many components of the original Enterprise, stored them, you know, in a hangar somewhere in a cargo bay, and maybe later, after the Enterprise was refit, someone stumbles upon this, you know, batch of components from the original Enterprise and decides, hey, I bet you we can rebuild the original Enterprise based on all these discarded components. Can't we reassemble the old Enterprise out of the pieces that were discarded? Assuming they weren't totally damaged and absolutely needed to be replaced, or assuming they're still functional pieces. And I remember reading a novel, I think it was called Crossover by Michael Jan Friedman, and there's an example in that book where there's a Constitution-class ship, the Yorktown, that has been part of the Fleet Museum. And so when the Yorktown was donated to the Fleet Museum, its bridge module had been damaged, and they ended up replacing the Yorktown's bridge module with the bridge module from the original Enterprise, the one we see from the original series. And that always fascinated me. You know, imagine walking onto another starship, not the Enterprise, walking onto the Yorktown, but one component of that ship is the bridge module from the original Enterprise. It shocks the characters in that novel, and I think it would shock me if I walked into a ship like that. But we don't think of that as the Enterprise. We think of it as the Yorktown, right? So you have this fascinating part-whole relationship. What there's the Enterprise as a ship, you have the Yorktown as a ship, you have all the components that make up those ships, and what if you start swapping them in and out or replacing the components and building new starships out of the components? How many starships do you have? In some sense, does the Yorktown becomes the Enterprise if you start replacing the Yorktown's components with all of the Enterprise's components?
So I think, Zachary, we have to go back to Leibniz's law and ask the question, are either one of them actually the Enterprise? And again, in order for A and B to be indiscernible, then both A and B have to have the same properties. So A and B would be identical. They're not identical. They're not really a reflection in terms of their parts and pieces. You know, neither one of them would be the ship Theseus, starship Theseus.
As I was preparing for the show today, Mike, I encountered an example that I hadn't seen before. And the example was of this is not a Star Trek example, but it's a fun example to think about. And it has a little bit of Star Trek application. There was this British band called the Suga Babes. And I'm sure I'm not pronouncing this right. Not sugar with an R, Suga Babes. Suga Babes. As the story goes, as I understand it, there were originally some number of band members. And over time, the band members left and new band members became part of the band. But despite the people coming and going from the band, the entity, Suga Babes, the band persists, right? But what happened in this case is that the original band members, the original founding members of Suga Babes, got back together and formed yet another band. So now we've got an interesting case where, you know, all the components of this band, Suga Babes, had been swapped in and out, right? There were totally new band members, and yet the band as a whole persists. But all the original components, all the original band members themselves got back together and formed a new band. So which of these two bands is Suga Babes?
Yeah, is it Jefferson Airplane? Is it Jefferson Starship?
That's a great example. Yeah, Jefferson Starship, right? So that got me thinking, what about Starship crew assignments? You know, suppose you had rotating crew assignments where some members of the Enterprise crew were rotated out over time such that the entire crew of the Enterprise gets replaced, you know, over a decade or two. But all, you know, again, this is a thought experiment, right? But suppose, you know, all of those original crew members got back together on a new Starship. Maybe it was the Enterprise A, right? Or maybe it was the refit Enterprise. It doesn't matter. Maybe they were reassigned to the Enterprise at a later date. Is it, is that crew still the original crew, even though they're not part of the same ship anymore? And it's a fascinating example. It's a little bit different of an example than the Starship example proper. But, you know, rotating crew assignment strikes me as an example of something that creates the same problem, right? You have a Starship crew as a whole, the crew of the Enterprise, right? You have a noun phrase for it, the crew of the Enterprise. What does that refer to? Well, it's going to refer to the same group, the same entity, right? The same conglomeration of people who serve on the Enterprise, regardless of who's actually filling those roles. And suppose they all get rotated out and then reassigned to another ship later. Do we have two instances of the same crew of the Enterprise?
Yeah, I think they visited that question actually in The Visitor, Deep Space Nine. You know, how did we ever get by with two-dimensional consoles and you know. Of course, Nog was captain, so that, you know, that changes the whole thing. Nog is captain. That's a disturbing thought. So yeah, you know, this is a very interesting problem that we've kind of dug into here. So, you know, how do we respond? How do we reconcile this problem?
There's a number of ways we can go, and I think what's fun about this discussion for me is taking the tools of academic philosophy proper. You know, how do philosophers really talk about the problem of identity in these academic circles? What theories and what views and what distinctions and terms can they bring to the table that can help shed light on this, you know, interesting question of whether the enterprise remains the same over time? So we've got a few different theories and views we want to work through, and I suggest we just go through them one by one and see if any of them can shed light on the puzzle inside the Star Trek universe.
All right, well, go ahead and start us out.
The first one that comes to mind for me is the possibility of answering this problem, the problem of identity over time, by talking about the continuity of the changes that an object undergoes. Right, you know, we don't normally think of change over time as being a radical process, right? If we think about how the components of the enterprise are swapped in and out over time, right? Oftentimes it's a question of the engineer or some crew member swapping out one component at a time, right? The bridge module gets replaced, or we use the example of a single stem bolt getting replaced, or a console getting replaced by Chief O'Brien, right? Those changes are really gradual changes, right? You have a fairly complex entity. The enterprise has a great many components, and we're not talking about replacing all those components at once. We're talking about a single entity that undergoes very, very gradual changes, such that any one of those changes is not a threat to the coherence of the object as a whole. So just, one possible answer is that, as long as the changes are gradual enough and minute enough, then yeah, the entity as a whole persists even despite those changes. And in my mind, that's not a really adequate response, because there are these cases of radical change, like I think the example of the Enterprise refit is an example of radical change, right? That's not an example of steady, continuous change. That's an example of them driving the Enterprise into a hangar, literally dismantling a good portion of the ship, replacing a lot of components such that it looks like a completely different ship, and then, leaving the hangar bay still as the Enterprise. And that doesn't strike me as a very continuous change. So I think this idea of continuity of change addresses some kinds of situations, and respects our intuitions that minor changes don't really matter so much. But it doesn't strike me as being able to account for the full range of these kinds of examples, especially the radical cases like the refit Enterprise.
Yeah, it's interesting because, and I know we'll dig into personal identity a little bit more next week, but my mind goes to Deep Space Nine when we're talking about Vedic Barayal, looking at, the surgery that he had to undergo to replace part of his brain. And when he came out of that surgery, he was very changed. So Dr. Bashir says to Kira, if we take him back in and we operate on the other part of his brain, the man that comes out is not going to be the same man that you knew. He's not going to be the same Barayal. So there they were kind of dealing with this this question of identity. And I think that's probably, again, we'll deal with it more when we're talking about personal identity. But in terms of a ship, when we're looking at, the continuity of change over time, replacing a part here and a piece there, I think it's, and there's no real answer for it, I don't believe. But, at what point does that cease to be, in our example, the Enterprise? At what point do we cross that point of no return? We pull out that magical piece, that magical component that takes us in. As ridiculous as it is, I go back to, Archer kind of sitting there in his chair doing the math when, he gets the repair report from Trip, kind of doing the math and figuring out, okay, have we passed the point of no return? Do we have to put a 0.1 on the hull? Do we have to change the registry plate? Do we have to, the dedication plate rather? So, and again, there's no answer to that, but it bears asking the question.
I know we're going to talk about personal identity next week, but I like the example you mentioned of Vedic Barayal, because that's a case where, if you talk about the example of a person, right, I think of myself as the same person I was yesterday, right? Except I have a few new memories, a few new experiences, I've lost a few more skin cells, right? Very minor changes, right? But there's a case, in the example of Vedic Barayal, there's a case where a person undergoes a fairly radical change in personality, right? I generally feel like the same person I was yesterday, right? Very minor changes. But if you undergo some sort of brain surgery, right, you have a radical personality change that can take place. And we do talk this way of that person being a different person because of the severity of the change. And that doesn't strike me as a continuous change anymore. So where this answer, I think, is really helpful is in helping us draw the line, right? If there are steady, continuous changes, that appeals more to our intuitions that those changes are not as important from the sense of identity over time. Where those changes are more dramatic or sharper or happen in greater quantity, that appeals more to our intuition that maybe, yeah, we have a different object, a different starship, a different person, depending on the severity of the changes. So I think the continuity of change can help us draw the line, but it doesn't really answer the metaphysical question, right? If we go right back to Leibniz's law and strict numerical identity, it doesn't matter what the scope of the changes are. How, you know, if you've lost even a single skin cell as a person, you're not numerically identical with your former self because your properties are different. Likewise, in the case of the Enterprise or Deep Space Nine, if it's a single stem bolt that's been replaced, that might be a small continuous change, and that might be very consistent with our intuitions that the ship or the station persists over time and it is not a different ship or station. But that object is not, strictly speaking, numerical with itself anymore, right? It has a different set of properties than it used to have. So, you know, Leibniz is going to keep creeping up in the discussion and saying, well, wait a minute, we're talking about two things that are not numerically identical anymore. The continuity of change doesn't address the metaphysical issue. It does seem to help us draw the line, though.
Yeah, and I think another example is adding to an object such as they did when they added a third nacelle to the Enterprise in the Next Generation. I think they changed that whole thing. It was like a dreadnought class ship when they were done, but you know, it has this third nacelle now, and it's seemingly the same Enterprise, but it's bigger, it's badder, it's got bigger teeth, and you know, so the question remains: is this the same object? You know, how did that continuity of change affect the identity of that object?
Yeah, and I think what's fun about watching episodes like that, you know, in the finale of The Next Generation, you know, we see the Enterprise with three nacelles, and there's this kind of mental gymnastics you go through, right? You go, wait a minute, it's the Enterprise. Oh, but it's not the Enterprise. This one has three nacelles. Oh, wait, there's all this stuff that's in common. I know this bridge, except it looks a little different. It can't be the same. And you kind of go back and forth on these intuitions, and that's part of what's fun, I think, about seeing you know, these examples in Star Trek where they take something that's well-known and they put it in an alternate timeline or put it far in the future, and things aren't quite the same, and there's kind of a cognitive dissonance that shows up. It's like seeing an old friend after 10 or 15 years, right? You know, there's a lot that's the same. You have some shared experiences, but they've undergone a lot of new experiences. And you go sort of go, I don't really know this person anymore. It's like seeing, you know, the Enterprise with three nacelles is kind of like that. You know, Picard, you know, is on the Enterprise in the future, and he knows the ship and he doesn't know the ship at the same time. And that's a fun intuition. I think that's what accounts for a lot of the fun of watching those kinds of episodes.
Yeah, for sure. Then we have the response of four-dimensionalism.
So in addition to the continuity of change response to this problem of identity over time, there's also a view that is sometimes called four-dimensionalism and sometimes called perdurantism. And again, that's a big word. We're going to use a lot of big words as we go through various episodes of Metatrex. But let's call it four-dimensionalism. And the idea in this case, and what's fun about this view is it's a metaphysical view. This is not something you're going to discover in looking at the world around you. And metaphysics, like I said at the beginning of the show, often tries to postulate, you know, things that are beyond physics, things that are not observable in reality, the physical reality around us, but are necessary to explain some feature of reality. So on this view, which is a very sort of highly metaphysical view, right? The idea is that objects don't just exist in three dimensions, they actually exist in four dimensions spread out over time. So imagine that. So any object that exists in the physical reality, according to this view, is just a slice of this very four-dimensionally spread out entity. Like, so if we're going back to using the Enterprise as an example, imagine the Enterprise in a moment in time would be a slice of some four-dimensional string of Enterprises spread out in time. And that four-dimensional string of Enterprises itself is one four-dimensional object. And so on this view, what we see in individual moments in time are not objects that are sort of complete and standalone, they themselves are components of these four-dimensional objects spread out in the fourth dimension of time. And it's hard to envision, and I'm trying to come up with a visual to help make this clear. And again, it's hard to do in a podcast because we don't have a whiteboard in front of me, right? I would love to draw a picture of this to kind of help make the intuition clear. But the picture that comes to my mind as I think about this in Star Trek is a picture of the Enterprise going into warp. You know, you see a trail left behind of the Enterprise in the moment that the Enterprise goes into warp. Imagine that trail being the Enterprise in different moments in time. Each one of those prior moments, each part of the trail corresponds to an Enterprise in a particular moment. And all of the entire history of every single object that exists is like this. We all leave these sort of four-dimensional trails behind us. And I, as a person in reality, or the Starship Enterprise as an object in reality, is just a time slice of this four-dimensional object. You can't visualize a four-dimensional object, but imagine something just spread out over time such that every slice corresponds to a moment in reality.
Yeah, we're really digging into really deep waters here. We're digging into a question of temporal, non-spatial abstracts, things like immaterial souls, the nature of time. I mean, we're going Deep Space Nine, wormhole aliens, linear versus non-linear time. It almost might be a whole separate discussion altogether. But it's really fascinating to think about, you know, these little slices of time and looking at an object in each of those slices of time and really asking all of these questions that we've been asking about that object in every state or place of time. I almost feel like I need to say, I live here, you know.
What's interesting about this theory, I think, is that it goes so counter to our intuitions, right? I don't think of myself as being a four-dimensional object spread out in time. I think of myself as a three-dimensional object living in a moment right here, right now, and sort of moving through time, right? What's weird about this view is it seems to not account for the passage of time in the sort of experiential sense, right? I experience myself moving through time, but if I'm really just an object spread out in four dimensions, spread out over time, and each little slice of that four-dimensional membrane corresponds to me at a particular moment, or the Enterprise at a particular moment. It's hard to capture the movement through time, right? In some sense, that four-dimensional object is permanent and fixed, and itself doesn't really change. So this is what I think is fun about metaphysics, right? You can postulate these new ways of thinking of reality, and in creating one problem, in solving one problem, you tend to create another problem, right? So if the Enterprise is really a four-dimensional object spread out through time, and each slice in that membrane is an Enterprise in a particular moment, well, how does the Enterprise move through time? How do the crew members on the Enterprise experience the passage of time if that four-dimensional object is fixed and all the moments in future history and past history of the Enterprise are just components or slices of this four-dimensional membrane? So it seems to solve the identity problem, right? If each time slice of the Enterprise is just part of the same membrane, that gives us some sense of identity over time, right? We can say those two time slices are the same because they're part of the same larger metaphysical structure, this four-dimensional, what I'm calling a membrane. But it creates another problem, right? How do the crew members on the Enterprise experience passage of time? How do they experience being in a particular moment and having that moment change from one moment to the next as Data's internal chronometer ticks one moment to the next, right? How do the Enterprise crew members experience the passage of time? So this metaphysical view seems to solve the identity problem, or at least give some approach to solving it, but it doesn't really respect the intuition of time. And I do want to spend more time talking about the metaphysics of time in another episode, because this is just one of many different metaphysical theories of time, but it's one that I think the listeners will be largely familiar with, the idea that objects can be spread out in multiple dimensions. That is an idea that is friendly to the ideas that you get from contemporary physics. Certainly in Star Trek, you get talk of multiple dimensions, many different places. So this shouldn't be, language out in left field for a great many viewers of Star Trek, I hope. But it doesn't necessarily solve the problem. I think it creates this view, four-dimensionalism, or this view that objects are just slices in four-dimensional time, just creates as many problems as it solves. And, you know, you want a metaphysical theory that doesn't postulate about a bunch of unnecessary elements, right? This is a very metaphysically heavy theory, right? It postulates multiple dimensions, and it postulates objects that exist and spread out in these different dimensions, these metaphysical membranes of objects, four-dimensional membranes and whatnot. And, you know, I think just like in the sciences, scientists tend to prefer explanations that are simple, right? This is the principle of Occam's razor. Metaphysicians, I think, have the same kind of principle. They don't like postulating a bunch of unnecessary entities if they don't have to. So if there's a simpler, less metaphysically heavy way of explaining the problem of identity over time without postulating multiple dimensions and four-dimensional membranes, maybe that's a better theory. You know, four-dimensionalism, it's a fascinating view. You really have to do some mental gymnastics to visualize what would it mean to take a ship like the Enterprise and stretch it out over time in four dimensions and think of individual enterprises as moments in time consisting of these slices of this large four-dimensional membrane. You know, that's, you really have to kind of, you know, get your piece of paper out and try to draw that if you can, or close your eyes and visualize what that would be. But it's a very heavy view, and it postulates a lot of metaphysical entities that may not be necessary. And some of the other responses, like the one we just talked about, the continuity of change response to the problem of identity over time, they don't have to postulate those metaphysical entities. So I think critics of this view might just say, look, this postulates too much. Even if it solves the problem, that's the only reason for thinking that these other metaphysical objects we just talked about exist. Maybe it creates as many problems as it solves. And if we don't need to postulate the existence of those entities, in other words, if we don't need to take those entities and add them to our ontology, our list of things that exist in reality, and we don't need to do that to explain something, then we shouldn't.
Yeah, and I think for practicality's sake, it doesn't really answer the question, you know, why. It just fails to even touch that basic question, why. And I think that's probably where Aristotle, I think, probably does a better job dealing with that.
Getting back real quick to the four-dimensionalism, you know, I think my concern about it is that it may not even solve the problem, right? If we're concerned that the Enterprise over time is not the same Enterprise because its components aren't the same, can't you run the same kind of reasoning about these time slices of this four-dimensional object, right? Isn't one time slice different from one other time slice at a different point in time, right? If that's the case, it just seems not to solve the problem. You can run the same kind of reasoning to generate the problem of identity with the time slices mm-hmm. themselves. So, you know, I think at worst, four-dimensionalism just doesn't even solve the problem.
Yeah, yeah.
So you wanted to talk about Aristotle.
So yeah, I want to talk a little bit about Aristotle. Aristotle held that there were four kinds of answers, I think, to the why question. And in terms of practicality, for instance, material cause, we're talking about the material that composes the moving or changing thing. You know, if we use the example of a table, it might be wood. You know, we're talking about materials, bronze, steel, marble, duranium, whatever the case may be. Then we talk about formal cause. You know, that's, we're talking about the arrangement, the shape, the appearance of that thing. We talk about efficient cause, sometimes called moving cause. We're talking about things apart from that thing being changed or moved, which interacts so that you know, they can be an agency to the change or movement. For example, the example I think of, you know, the efficient cause of a table might be the person building it, me doing, you know, doing the work. And then of course we have, you know, final cause. You know, it's at the end, you know, towards you know, what it's directing. In the case of our ship Theseus, starship Theseus, what is the mission? Has the mission changed?
So Aristotle had this view that if you want to give an account of how something came to be the way it is, you know, why does an object exist in the way it does, there are four things that you have to look at. There are four types of causes. Mike, you already mentioned the material cause, formal cause, efficient cause, and final cause. And of course, again, these are a lot of terms we're throwing around, but if you kind of take these types of causation, you apply them to something like the Enterprise, I think we can make good sense of this. The material cause, like you mentioned, Mike, are the components that make up the object in question. So when we're talking about the Enterprise, we're talking about the components like duranium, the whatever the stem bolts are made of, right? That's the materials, the raw materials out of which the object is created. The formal cause would be the structural arrangement of those materials. And I'm thinking of things like architectural diagrams, the mathematical relationships, the dimensions, the literal abstract form, right? If I'm drawing out the Enterprise, like when I was a kid, I had the Star Trek technical manual, Star Trek The Next Generation technical manual, which is great. And I know it was published a long time ago, but if people haven't picked that up over the years, you should definitely pick it up. But there are these great little architectural diagrams of the Enterprise inside of various Enterprises, but specifically the Enterprise D inside that book. So the formal cause would be represented by the abstract form, the arrangement within which these raw materials are arranged in order to create the object in question, right? So, you know, the circumference of the saucer section, the ratio of the saucer section to the engineering section, right? These are all components of the formal cause of the Enterprise. Now, the efficient cause would be literally the prior causes that brought this object into fruition, right? So when we're talking about the Enterprise, we're talking about, you know, the engineers who were literally building the Enterprise when it was first built. Or if we're talking about the efficient cause of the Enterprise in a moment in time, you know, say it's chief engineer Geordi LaForge replacing a bolt on the ship or replacing a computer console, right? That is the efficient cause of the change in question, right? So how did the object come into fruition? What caused it to be prior in time, and then for any individual, you know, change within time, for any time slice, to use the language of four-dimensionalism that we talked about a minute ago, you know, what is bringing about that change in a particular moment? That would be the efficient cause.
Yeah, because when Geordi is touching the engine, he's really touching Leah Brahms.
Right. Efficiently.
Efficiently.
And then, of course, we have the final cause. And for Aristotle, I think this is really important to understand about Aristotle. Aristotle had this view that objects develop or progress toward their natural ends, their natural goals. And there's a Greek word for that, telos, which means end or goal. And Aristotle's view is called a teleological view, that objects in reality progress toward their natural ends. And there are these really simple examples that come from Aristotle himself. An acorn tends to develop into an oak tree, and an oak tree is the natural end or the goal of an acorn. You know, left to its own development, unimpeded by any constraining factors. You know, if it has all the water it needs and the proper kind of soil, all those factors left aside, an acorn will naturally develop to be a beautiful oak tree. So you can ask the question, what is the goal of the Enterprise then? You know, what is the end purpose of the Enterprise? And what occurs to me here, what is an Aristotelian reading of the Starship Enterprise? What would Aristotle say is the final cause or the telos of the Starship Enterprise? And of course, what comes to mind for me is the mission to boldly go where no one has gone before, right? These are the purpose under which an object is created, right? Why does that object exist? And what is its goal, right? And the goal, of course, for the Enterprise is to go out and explore reality and expand the goals of the Federation. So, you know, when I hear final cause as it applies to the Enterprise, I hear the Enterprise's mission. What is its purpose? To boldly go where no one has gone before. So there's Aristotle's four causes as applied to the Enterprise. We have the material cause, the raw materials that the Enterprise is made of. We have the formal cause, the sort of engineering diagram type of abstraction that is the arrangement that these raw materials are put together to create the Enterprise. The efficient cause, you know, literally the causes that cause those raw materials to be arranged, you know, who built the Enterprise or who is making a change on the Enterprise, and then what is the purpose of the object, what is its goal or end result, and that is to, for the Enterprise, I think, just to boldly go where no one has gone before. So what does this mean for personal identity now? I think this is the interesting question. This is the topic at hand, right? Okay, so what? Aristotle has this view that there are four kinds of causes. Some of these seem to persist over time and some of them don't. As the components of the Enterprise are being replaced, the material cause seems to change, right? The Enterprise has different raw materials than it had before because its components have been changed. But if you move over to the next kind of cause, the formal cause, the form of the Enterprise can remain the same regardless of which particular bits of matter, which components are making up the ship. So as Aristotle would be thinking through, you know, personal identity as it applies to the Enterprise, I'm kind of doing these Aristotelian mental gymnastics, right? Okay. Yeah, okay, the Enterprise changes in some ways, the material changes, but the form of the Enterprise remains the same, right? It still has two nacelles, and it still has a saucer section. It still has the same overall form, despite the raw materials changing. In terms of the efficient cause, of course, that's going to change over time too, right? The efficient cause of the ship being built, of course, remains the same, but the efficient cause of these minor changes the ship undergoes will change over time. So that's going to change over time, I think, on Aristotle's view. But most importantly, the final cause for the Enterprise remains the same. Regardless of how many times the Enterprise is refit, and regardless of how many components are changed, the goal of the Enterprise, its purpose, to boldly go and explore where no one has gone before, that mission remains the same despite these changes. So I think Aristotle would say, well, is the Enterprise the same over time or not? Well, in two ways, yes. The formal cause, the structure of the ship remains the same and its mission remains the same. So in those senses, yes, it's the same Enterprise, right? Two of those causes are identical, but two of them are not. The material cause is not identical because the raw materials have been changed, the components have been swapped in and out, and the efficient causes come and go in time as those changes are undergone. Although the first efficient cause, the initial building of the ship, of course, remains the same over time because you can't go back and change the past. So Aristotle would say, is the Enterprise the same in time despite its changes or not? He would say, well, sort of. It's, you know, two of these components are the same and two of them are not. And that's all there is to it when it comes to the identity of the Enterprise over time. The only senses in which the Enterprise is the same over time are its structure and its mission. Everything else can change, but we could still have some sense of calling it the same Enterprise.
Yeah, indeed. So flip a coin, and
yeah, and of course, you know, Leibniz would say you're just dodging the question, right?
Exactly.
You know,
exactly.
If the materials are changing, then the Enterprise is not numerically identical with itself because its components are the same. So Aristotle would say, well, there's sort of two senses in which the Enterprise is the same, right? It has the same structure and it has the same mission, even though its components are being swapped and out. But Leibniz is there in the background, although Leibniz is much later than Aristotle in the history of philosophy. Leibniz would say, nope, you're just dodging the question, right? The second a stem bolt has been replaced, it's no longer numerically identical because the Enterprise has, in one moment in time, has different properties than the Enterprise in a future moment in time, and all bets are off, and the Enterprise is not the same from one moment to the next. So, you know, it's a convenient answer. You know, Aristotle gives us a lot to say about identity over time, but I think if you really want to apply the metaphysician's rigor to the discussion, Aristotle seems to be dodging the question.
Yeah, you know, mere logical essentialism says that an object cannot persist through a changing of its parts. So we're kind of back to Leibniz and you know, Leibniz's law.
Yeah, what's interesting to me is in a great many areas of thought, you get this question of emergentism and reductionism. Right, you can take the Enterprise and you can say, well, the Enterprise is just its components. The Enterprise is just a collection of things, right? It's a warp core and it's a couple nacelles and it's a bunch of stem bolts and it's some carpet on the bridge and, you know, whatever you want to talk about, right? It's a conglomeration of these basic components, each of which themselves has a bunch of basic components. So at every level, can't you just sort of eliminate the idea that the need to even talk about a ship as a whole? Can't you just say there is no such thing as the Enterprise? The Enterprise is just all these lower level components. And aren't those lower level components just whatever chemical compounds make up those components? And aren't those chemical compounds just atoms, right? So, you know, can you just kind of reduce the problem away by saying there is no such thing as a ship? You know, the whole problem of identity as it applies to the Starship Enterprise seems to take for granted that there even is a ship, a thing, a separate thing called a ship in addition to all of the components that make up that ship. And this is the question of emergence. Aside from all the components, when we're talking about the list of everything that exists in reality, in other words, our ontology, which is just our list of things that exist, do we have to add, in addition to atoms and molecules and chemical compounds, do we have to add things like carpet and carpet glue? Do we have to add things like warp cores and maintenance hatches and, you know, the various components that make up
Jeffrey's tubes?
Or do those things exist in addition to this very, very lower level physical description? And if you put those together in the right kind of way, do you also get this extra thing called starships, namely the Starship Enterprise? Does that exist above and beyond the existence of all the lower level components? And if the answer is no, if the Enterprise is literally just its components and there's no separate thing called the Enterprise, a starship, then the problem of identity goes away. We don't need to ask the question, is the Enterprise or is a starship the same over time? Because there's no such thing as starships on that view of reality, right? On a reductionist view of reality. On the other hand, if at every turn, when you put these basic components together in certain ways, if you get distinct novel kinds of entities that emerge out of those arrangements, and those emergent objects like starships have their own properties, you can then ask the question, well, do those properties persist over time? And I think this is what Aristotle is getting at. As you put those components together in a certain way, you get an emergent object like a starship, right? When you arrange them in a certain way, according to the formal cause, like the engineering diagrams that make up the arrangement of materials to form a starship, that arrangement can persist over time, but only if that arrangement is some sort of emergent property that can't be reduced to lower level descriptions of physical reality. So I love this discussion because it gets to the core of how we describe reality. When we ask these philosophical questions about these large macroscopic objects, one way to solve the problem is just to say, well, there are no such thing as starships. There are just Jeffrey's tubes and maintenance hatches and stem bolts. And maybe there aren't even those things. Maybe we can just reduce those to the lower level and just eliminate philosophical problems by saying that the entities in question don't exist. But that's not very satisfying, right? You know, in universe, there are things like starships, and they allow us to travel to strange new worlds. And, you know, that's not a very satisfying answer. It might be the right answer, but we can have some sense of talking about the persistence of these higher level properties over time, right? The Enterprise mission goes on and persists over time, regardless of which crew gets rotated in and out and which components get swapped in and out, right? That final cause or that mission of the Enterprise seems to endure over time. And that is non-trivial, I think. I think that when you're answering a philosophical question like this, you want to preserve that intuition. You don't want to eliminate it away.
Yeah. So basically, when you put carpet on the wall, you have the emergence of the 1701D.
Yeah, the USS Hilton, right? You can ask the question about hotels, right? You know, does the hotel Enterprise exist when you put carpet on the wall?
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Indeed, indeed. Well, Zachary, we've really dug in here. Any final thoughts?
Well, just that I'm going to say this many times over the course of having these episodes of MetaTreks, but I think this is a hard problem, right? Identity over time pulls at our intuitions, right? You know, what's fun about these examples, I think our intuitions just run counter to each other. We do want to say, yeah, from one moment to the next, I'm the same person, or the Enterprise is the same ship. Despite the passage of time and despite the changes that a person or the Enterprise undergoes. But our other intuitions, which are just as strong, are to say, wait a minute, no, the Enterprise refit is not the same ship as the Enterprise pre-refit, and we have conflicting intuitions. And I think this is what the value that talking about philosophy brings to the discussion, right? You want to try to find a way to reconcile these intuitions. And what's fun about personal identity, about the identity of objects over time. We're going to talk about personal identity next week. What does this mean for the identity of, crew members on the Enterprise over time? That's a discussion for next week. But as we talk about the changes of an object over time, just ordinary objects, you're almost forced into postulating metaphysical kinds of entities. And I love that view of four-dimensionalism because it just gets right to the heart of what metaphysics is about. You've got this problem that we observe in reality, these competing intuitions about whether an object is the same over time. And maybe the only way to solve that is to postulate some metaphysical entities like four dimensions and objects that exist in those four dimensions and time slices. And this is just such a fun topic to talk about because there's so many crazy theories. And when we get into the metaphysics of time in a future discussion, we're going to go into even more counterintuitive theories of what the nature of time is. So this is a fun topic, but it's one of the hard topics. I think any of these theories we talked about doesn't seem to really solve the problem in my mind. I still have these competing intuitions, and regardless of which possible response we're talking about, whether we're talking about the continuity of change response, the idea that an object is the same only if those changes are very small and gradual, whether we're talking about a very heavy metaphysical theory like four-dimensionalism, whether we're talking about Aristotle's causes saying that, some types of causation remains the same over time and some types of causation doesn't remain the same over time, whether we're just saying, well, the problem goes away because these higher level objects like starships don't exist in the first place, like reductionism would say. Regardless of which answer, I always have the other intuition in the back of my mind that, wait a minute, you've kind of eliminated the problem away or explained it away, but you want to preserve this intuition that an object is the same over time, not kind of explain it away and not solve the problem, right? I think, even if you say, okay, the problem is not a problem because of these metaphysical objects like four-dimensional time slices, right? the problem still creeps up. You can still go, wait a minute, aren't these time slices the same, different from each other over in different moments in time, just like objects in three dimensions seem to have different properties in different moments in time. So you can always, you know, take the other side of the coin, like any philosophical issue, but this one seems particularly strong for me. I think intuitions get pulled in multiple directions, and any possible response just seems to ignore the intuitions of the other side. And so, like a great many philosophical issues, the problem just persists. And, you know, have we solved the problem of whether the Enterprise really does exist over time? I don't think so. But what I hope to accomplish in talking about this issue on MetaTrex is to give people who are interested in this kind of discussion the tools and the terminology to have that discussion more intelligently than they were having it before, right? You know, probably people who are listening to this episode, unless they've talked about philosophy before, haven't thought much about four-dimensionalism and time slices, or maybe haven't thought about Aristotle's four different types of causes before. I hope that this new vocabulary gives people who are interested in this topic a new way to have the discussion and maybe shed some new light on the discussion that they couldn't do before listening to us talk about this today. So that's my final thoughts. Did we solve the issue? No, but I hope we added a lot to the discussion.
Yeah, these are definitely fascinating questions. And admittedly, Zachary, I'm really looking forward to exploring this in the context of living beings. But it's interesting, really, to think about how the parts of a whole relate to, in our best example here, a starship. And does that object remain the same as the parts undergo change? I don't necessarily view the NX-01 of Season 4 to be any different from the NX-01 of Season 1. Respectively, I don't know if I see the 1701 refit to be the same as the 1701 from the original series, but in truth, these are really kind of similar examples. So I have to confess that there's a conflict in my own philosophy. And that being said, you know, one of the things I appreciate about philosophy and something that really keeps me coming back to the philosophical themes and debates of Star Trek is that it's sometimes challenging to my own thinking. And so resolving those conflicts is kind of, it becomes its own lifelong pursuit towards a better understanding of the universe around me. So apart from being great science fiction, I think this is what makes Star Trek so enduring. So again, you know, I don't think we answered the question is the Enterprise the same Enterprise? I don't think there is an answer. Again, we say this all the time, but Star Trek raises the questions. It doesn't necessarily give us the answers. It's definitely great food for thought. And this was a great discussion.
Yeah, I hope listeners never think of the Ship of Theseus example the same way again. I hope they think of the Starship of Theseus whenever they think of this philosophical question. Whenever this idea comes up in their mind about their identity of themselves over time, or the identity of people they know over time, or the identity of objects over time, you know, go right back to thinking of the Starship of Theseus and the different ways we've cut it up here tonight. And I hope you get something out of the discussion. Well, Mike, it's been fun talking about the problem of identity over time and the Starship of Theseus tonight, but this isn't the only thing we've been talking about here on Trek FM this past week. So here's a look at some of the other things you may have missed elsewhere on the network.
Previously on Trek.fm, Standard Orbit.
A. Mugatu. B. Gorn. C. Tribble. Or D. Horta.
Isn't Mugatu from like Zoolander?
Here's the thing, right? Okay.
Earl Grey.
Oh, by the way, 6 hours in. If you press shift, you'll run throughout the whole game.
Press shift when your characters are moving, and they'll actually move at a
reasonable
pace.
The orb.
If he had like a game card, his power, you know, like, would be higher than any other captain for their persuasion power.
You'll be like, damn, I was winning, and then he went and played a Cisco card on me.
The Ready Room.
Here's one more thing I want to throw out here for you guys. Recasting this episode, because I know you guys like to do this on To the Journey with things, with series and such. I think that Ma'ab should be played by Will Ferrell.
Yeah!
To the Journey!
there is that moment where badass Janeway plunges down with a phaser rifle in hand and takes command of the situation. And so there is that redeeming moment.
That is an awesome moment, but it always pissed me off because I'm like, why would you send the captain down first?
Right?
Commentary, Trek Stars.
Lost World's a terrible movie. I haven't seen Jurassic World, though.
The 602 Club.
We wake up in the middle of the night, and I pop back in episode 5, and I watch it again. Like, there's something about this movie that from even then, you know, I'd seen them all, it's all clean slate. This one was already my favorite.
Literary Treks.
It definitely starts in a very dark place, and it doesn't get much brighter at all, you know, until we get to the end, and you know, there's some hope there. But yeah, definitely, it's a dark book.
Women at Warp.
And then Tom's basically like, well, after we like infiltrate the fortress, we'll free Chaotica's harem. And no, like we've...
It's going to turn out they're already being freed by Furiosa, and it's going to turn into a whole nother holodeck program.
Meta Treks.
I want Lieutenant Commander Einstein sitting at my conference table briefing.
Would that be a blue shirt?
He would totally be a blue shirt.
Just making sure.
And you know, even though the bushy mustache is technically not Starfleet regulation, I'd let him keep it.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
Check out these shows and find out what we're talking about in your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe and beyond. You'll find us wherever you get your podcasts. If you're an Apple user, be sure to hit the subscribe button. That helps us out greatly and makes it easier for other listeners to find the show as they search iTunes. If you're not an Apple user, we've got you covered as well. You can find our shows on Stitcher, TuneIn, Spreaker, SoundCloud, Windows Phone, and of course you can stream and download the MP3 file from our website and grab the RSS link as well. Another way you can help us keep all of our shows coming to you each week is to become a patron of the network on Patreon. If you visit patreon.com/trekfm, that's patreon.com/trekfm, you'll find our current goals and different milestone contribution levels, along with all the great perks we have for you. These perks include early access to content, exclusive content, producer credits, seats in our content development team, and more. We really appreciate any support you can give us and hope you'll join the team. Again, you'll find all the details at patreon.com/trekfm. And don't forget to check out Enterprise in Space, a project of the nonprofit National Space Society that will design and launch an 8-foot orbiter and return the craft to Earth. The NSS Enterprise Orbiter will carry more than 100 student-designed science experiments into space, and you can help make it happen. Visit enterpriseinspace.org to find out more and to get your seat on the mission. If you'd like to contact us to give us feedback or suggestions for the show, you can do so in many different ways. One way is to contact us via the contact form on Trek.fm's website. Just go to trek.fm/contact.
You can also leave us a voicemail, look at the sidebar on the show page, or go to speakpipe.com/trek.fm.
On Twitter, you can reach us under the username @trek.fm.
You can also find us on Facebook, facebook.com/trek.fm. Also on the Babel Conference, type the Babel Conference, that's B-A-B-E-L, into the search field on Facebook, or go to our website at trek.fm and click discussion on the menu bar. The Babel Conference is a closed group, but if you ask to join, we'll let you right in. You can join in on the discussion.
If you have a spare moment, we also invite you to leave a rating and a review of Meta Treks on iTunes. We'd love to hear your feedback and suggestions for the show, and leaving a rating and review helps other listeners on iTunes find our show. I'd like to take a few moments to thank several people who have left feedback on our new show Meta Treks on Twitter. I'd like to thank Amanda Bryant. Her username is just Amanda K. Bryant. She says, this seems like a really cool podcast on Star Trek and philosophy. So thank you for that comment, Amanda. We'd also like to thank Andy Russell. His username is just Russell Writing. Andy says, two of my favorite things, philosophy and Star Trek, have come together in something beautiful in Meta Treks on Trek FM. Well, thank you, Andy. Thank you for the feedback, and we're glad you're enjoying the show. And I'd also like to acknowledge several people who've just contributed with tweets and retweets and said some positive things about the show. I'd like to thank Regina P. I'd like to thank Terry Dufellin. I'd like to thank Mitch Webb, Michelle, whose username is just SpellingQueen25. I'd also like to thank the University of Detroit Mercy at UDM Philosophy. And I'd like to thank Philosophy Matters. And the username is Philosophy Matters MTTRS. So thank you for those tweets and retweets. You know, doing so helps other people find the show, and we appreciate all your comments and suggestions, especially the level of enthusiasm about our new show, Meta Treks. This is a labor of love for us, and we're pleased you're enjoying the show. Well, Mike, why don't you tell our listeners where they can find you on the interwebs?
Yeah, you can find me at Facebook through the Babel Conference. I'm also on Twitter. My username is at cmichael1701. Zachary, how about you? Where can our listeners find you on the interwebs?
Well, likewise, you can find me on the Babel Conference. And of course, if you want to comment or join the discussion on anything we talked about personal identity here today, the Babel Conference is an excellent place to do it. The Babel Conference, like we mentioned before, is just Trek FM's listeners group. So members of the Babel Conference are all Trek FM listeners, and you will encounter nothing but polite, respectful, engaging discussions on every possible corner of the Star Trek universe inside the Babel Conference. So find us on the Babel Conference and join the discussion. But you can also find me on Twitter, and my username is just my name, Zachary Fruhling. That's ZACHARYFRUHLING.
And finally, we want to acknowledge several people here at Trek FM. First of all, C. Brian Jones, founder and publisher of Trek FM, executive producers, Charlene Smith, Matthew Rushing, Norman Lau, our art director, Aaron Harvey, content manager, Will Nguyen, production manager is Richard Marquez, and our editor and producer, Dennis Costello. Well, thanks everyone for listening to MetaTreks, a Star Trek philosophy podcast. Until next time, when we will once again boldly go where no philosophers have gone before.